You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 42 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Professor Carlton Shieldchief-Gover, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey through North America's rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. Very excited to be announcing this new series in collaboration with the Plains Anthropological Society, where we will be interviewing recent authors in the quarterly journal about their research that has been published or about to be released. And today I'm really thrilled to be joined by Dr. Robert Horde and Dr. Zachary Day. For those that might not know, Dr. Bob Horde is the former state archaeologist of Kansas. He received his PhD from the University of Missouri Columbia. And his major focus has been the Central Plains of the United States, with primary interest being in ceramic vessel production, function, and quantitative compositional analysis of artifacts to better understand trade works. Retired as a state archaeologist in 2022. And Dr. Zachary Day received his doctorate degree from the Department of Anthropology, University of Kansas, Rock Chalk. And his dissertation uses geochemistry methods to better understand community networking of Eastern Plains middle woodland communities, including Kansas City Hopewell, Central Missouri Hopewell, Cuesta Cooper, and Eastern Kansas Middle Woodland. He's currently working as an archaeologist with the Bureau of Land Management in California. Bob and Zach, thank you guys so much for joining a podcast. Bob, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing pretty well. And I really like the collaboration with Plains Anthropologist. It's an absolutely essential journal for the region, and this will just strengthen things.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Zach, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm good. Just trying to keep my head down as we are in wildfire season out here in California.
Oh. Hey, I just came up from incredible wildfires in southwestern Kansas.
Yikes.
Yeah, it was a trip.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so stay strong.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So today we are talking about Bob and Zach's recent article. It was published in March of 2026. And the title of the research article is Ceramic Artifacts from the 2019 Excavations at the Tobias Site, 14 RC8, Evidence of Local Manufacture and Trade at a Great Bend Aspect Site. So the link to that article will be in the episode description. So for those that are interested, you need to either have a subscription through Taylor and Francis, or if you join the Plains Anthropological Society, you get access to our journal. So really trying to drum that up. If you want to see this article for yourself, please go ahead, become a member. Boom, you get access to all of the back catalog immediately. So please consider that. So I'll leave this up. Let's float this volleyball in the air to you, Zach. What is the Tobias site and what's Great Bend Aspect Archaeology?
Well, I think Bob will be able to answer the second part of that, but the Tobias site is essentially a Great Bend Aspect Little River focused site that is in Rice County in central Kansas. And it is a very large village site that has had years worth of excavation. The 2019 excavation that this paper is focused on the ceramics for, they pulled out over 16,000 ceramic sherds. And the paper that Bob and I put out was really focused on trying to start answering some of the questions about the manufacture of those pots. But I will let Bob answer more about what the Great Bend Aspect and the Little River focus will be.
So between about 1400 and 1700 CE, Wichita and Kansas were separated into two groups or foci. The Lower Walnut, which is down by Arkansas City on the Arkansas River, and Little River focus, which is on the Great Bend of the Arkansas. And there's a couple of Sharps Creek and the Tobias site are the two most important sites in the Little River focus. And they had their 1400, 1700 AD, large population structures also, there are habitation structures, but also structures that are thought to be ceremonial. They're kind of kidney bean shaped structures around the edge of a circle. And there you find more trained goods and more ceremonial objects. These are pretty robust populations. I can't estimate the number of people, but certainly several hundred, possibly thousands, living in robust grass structures that lasted several years. They were probably farming in the surrounding hills, corn and beans, but also going out west, at least for the Little River focus, out west to hunt bison on the Great Plains.
Excellent. And so as the Great Bend aspect itself is been ascribed as being ancestral to the Wichita and affiliate tribes, correct, Bob?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, awesome. And so Tobias has been excavated before. So the more recent excavations in 2019 by the Kansas Historical Society, which you were the state archaeologist for, so the State Archaeology of Kansas is within Kansas Historical Society. And so this was an excavation with the Kansas Archaeological Training Program, is that correct?
That's correct.
Excellent. So what led you guys to focus on the Tobias site as part of those excavations?
Right. Dr. Nikki Klarman, who's currently the state archaeologist, was focused on looking at this site. It's been excavated repeatedly, but there's a lot there. You could spend a lot of time there. But she wanted to get a better understanding of the site itself and its complexity. I also wanted this to serve as an impetus to analyze some of the older collections, which that has happened because in our paper, we look at some of the older collections as well as new. And in forthcoming publications, we'll also be looking at previously excavated material. One of the reasons this site was selected is the Midwest Center of the National Park Service did a geophysics workshop there. And they used several different geophysical techniques to evaluate the site as a demonstration, but also to get the information. And so we were ground truthing some of those anomalies that showed up at those. So using new technology to understand this site, that it wasn't just excavation. There was systematic survey, surface survey done on the site. And it's a large site. Don't know how many acres, but many acres. And the biggest portion of it is owned by the Kansas Historical Society. Nikki also wanted to create a long-term plan for treatment of the site, and that includes archaeological work, which might include leaving it alone, but also how to maintain the vegetation on the site, how to best interpret it. And Nikki is very committed to working with the Wichita and affiliated nations on this, and she's got a good working relationship with them. So it's done with good consultation.
Excellent. So a major aspect of these later period sites, so like looking at the ceramic period in Kansas, named so because we have ceramics, right? How are Great Bend aspect site ceramics more generally described? And then how are there any differences that you've seen coming out of the specific assemblage from Tobias?
These are really neat vessels. They're large vessels. They're described as amphora shaped, you know, so think of a Greek amphora, but for the uninitiated in Greek pottery, they start from either flat or rounded bottom. They rise up, not so much rounded. They're kind of rising up at an angle. They have a distinct shoulder that then rises up into a vertical neck and a round rim. Sometimes they have handles attached. So they're really, in my mind, unique in the Great Plains. And you find this not only in the Little River aspect where the Tobias site is, but in the Lower Walnut sites down in southeastern Kansas as well. They're pretty big vessels too. I'd be guessing if I was estimating their volume, but a couple liters maybe. And they are used as cooking vessels, but they might also be used as storage vessels.
Okay, excellent. And so, Zach, how did you get involved with the analysis of the Tobias material? Were you part of this field school, or were you working in a lab environment after the excavations had been completed?
So I was working in a lab environment. I was at the time working on my dissertation, and Bob was also on my committee. So he understood what my geophysical analysis was going to involve and a lot of the potentials that it could do. But in particular, he was really interested in the non-destructive or minimally destructive aspects of my analysis, particularly because one of the pieces, and we'll discuss it later, but one of the pieces from the Tobias site that was really unique was a piece of white slipped ware that was the only one found during that entire excavation. And it was the only sherd found out of the 16,000 that was white slipped. Additionally, we found other decorative pieces. Other decorative pieces were discovered during this excavation. I think about 900, give or take, red slipped ware, as well as several hundred decorated pieces, whether it was cord marked, stamped, fabric impressed, incised, cord marked, and whatnot. And at the time, like I said, I was working on my dissertation, which was looking at several hundred sherds from Kansas City Hopewell, as well as 13 locations with rock lay sourcing to try to identify whether or not ceramics were being manufactured locally or exotic materials specifically. And we really wanted to try to apply that to a small selection of sherds from Tobias, just to answer the initial question of, were they using the most readily available clay material at Tobias to construct some of these ceramic vessels, including the unique ones, such as that white slip piece.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, we'll be talking more about the pottery in the next segment, and specifically that white slip pottery. So kind of keeping that clay sourcing aspect, was it surprising? So let me backtrack a little bit. Doing the clay sourcing and looking at production, like, what were some surprises or trends that you guys saw with how local clays were being used or not used with the pottery assemblage itself?
So one of the reasons of several that motivated me to work with Zach on this is, when these people were excavating their storage pits, you go down through the A horizon, the weathered upper horizon, but then you immediately get into a very dense clay B horizon. It lies all throughout the site. It's a pain in the rear to get through, dense clay. So there's clay readily available as they are excavating a storage pit that they already need. It seems like a perfect resource. It's right there. It's a waste product if you don't use it. Not only is there a source there, the buried B stratum, if you go to the Little River, which is immediately adjacent to the site, there is sorted clay. The sand stays put, the clay moves down until it gets to slower water and it's deposited. So there's levigated deposits of clay right there available in the immediate vicinity of the site. And frankly, I was absolutely certain that when Zach did his analysis, we also analyzed some of these clays, some from one of the pit features and some from the river, I was sure that they were going to be a match using the local clay. I'd fired some test tiles of them. They hold up. You could build a pot out of them. Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise, indeed. Well, all right. And on that, we're going to go ahead and take our first, our only break. And we'll be right back here on episode 42 with Bob and Zach. So stay tuned. And we're back. So continuing our conversation about the ceramics from the site, looking at kind of a theme of evidence for trade and interaction. So what does this tell us or tell archaeologists about approximately 2% of ceramics originating from lower walnut focus sites?
That really surprised me. I just assumed that we were going to find strong interaction. I was expecting lower walnut gets some caddo vessels. I was expecting some of those to ride up, it's right upstream. I was expecting an aunt and uncle relationship, and we're just not seeing it. The shell tempered stuff that shows up, it's hardly any of it. The lithics are different between the two sites. It's like the lower walnut folks, they're sitting right on top of the good Florence chert deposits, but you'd think some more of that would come up into Tobias, and it doesn't. We're getting a lot more trade with the west and the southwest, as reflected by a few ceramic sherds that come in, maybe some Apachean ware, the micaceous stuff, but also the obsidian that comes in pretty good volumes. And the lithic material for the Tobias site is coming from further north and west of the site rather than from south and east. I would project that indicates that their hunting forays are going up into that area of the plains. And while they're out there, they conveniently retool. There's a lot of Smoky Hill silicified chert sources out there that they can utilize while they're in the neighborhood. So big surprise that all the Great Bend Aspect folks aren't holding hands all the time.
Right. And so through the assemblage, who does it seem like the Tobias is interacting with more? So if it's not this like broader lower walnut, is it more of like a southwest preference, or what are we seeing?
There's some Dismal River representation in the lithics and in some of the ceramics. But Dismal River, we should ask Margaret Beck and Matt Hill and those folks, but they're pretty mobile. They're not as settled and engaged, and they seem like a completely different bird than Great Bend Aspect. And you would expect culturally similar groups to have more in common, more exchange. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing a relationship of the Tobias site with the folks out west who are more similar to hunter-gatherers. Is that making any sense at all?
Yeah, right. No, that makes sense, right? Because Dismal River is ancestral Apache. They're coming out of Montana, Wyoming, onto the Western Plains, settling in Kansas and Colorado. Much different lifestyle. We see interactions with them around the same time with Scott County Pueblo further west.
Right.
And, you know, like with my own background at Lynch, where we have a Caddoan group through CPT interact with Oneota, it is locally sourced pottery. They're adopting some Oneota designs, but it's predominantly still CPT in origin. And so looking at like this ancestral Wichita site, where it's like they're doing more Southwestern things, yeah, it is peculiar because, right, these are structured communities of practice with, you know, different ancestral roots. And then also like who their descendants are also, you know, Apaches and Wichitas are very different people in many different ways.
Yeah.
So,
why do archaeology?
Right? Like it's finding things that don't, like, you know, as you said, like this was unexpected. And when things are unexpected, that's when it becomes like really interesting. It's like, well, wait a minute, this is not, this is running against the grain. So, but more broadly, Bob, as a state archaeologist, former state archaeologist of Kansas, working in so many different components, like how do we distinguish trade, migration, and cultural influence through ceramics in particular?
Basically, the structure of the vessels typically is different enough between different cultural areas that, you know, you can make a pretty good judgment. You know, thank goodness Zach's around, because you don't want to just ride with that assumption. You want to test that assumption. And sometimes your assumptions fall by the wayside with the result of testing. I like to use quantitative analysis on artifacts rather than looking at it stylistically and saying, I know what that is. That's fine as far as it goes, but to test it and see what the source material is, I think is critically important to have a better understanding of what human interaction and exchange is like.
Absolutely. And so, Zach, this is where your background kind of and the methodologies that you're using for your dissertation start to come into play. So what were those methods you were using to help understand these interactions and sourcing of these artifacts?
So the method that we used for this particular study was X-ray diffraction to try to condense a complex technique into a short little elevator blurb. Basically, X-ray diffraction is able to analyze and differentiate how atoms are forming crystalline structures. So think back to basic chemistry. We'll go real simple. Water is H2O. But you never see water molecules portrayed in any literature or pictures as being anything but the V shape, with the large atom and then the two smaller hydrogen atoms, kind of like in a V shape or Mickey Mouse. That's because that structure is consistent for water. And for minerals, specifically particular versions of minerals, even if they have the same elemental makeup, they can form structures in different shapes, and that's going to lead to a different mineral. And X-ray diffraction is sensitive enough that it can actually differentiate, even if it has all of the same elements, how these structures are different. And that's kind of the key aspect of what this was doing, because it was looking at not just the clay minerals, but all of the minerals that are within the sample. And then it's essentially assigning a sum fingerprint to each of the patterns. What we found is that in all of the raw clay samples that were collected and analyzed, they were almost identical across the board. It didn't matter if it was the B horizon from the site or the alluvial deposits closer to the river. They were pretty much homogeneous across the board. And if you actually overlay those fingerprints on one on top of the other, it's almost identical across all of the samples. But oddly enough, none of the ceramics matched. And we didn't just overlay these X-ray diffraction patterns. We also did a cluster analysis, which is a statistical analysis that basically looks at the entire X-ray diffraction pattern and basically calculates groups based off of a centroid and variations, and it kind of identifies what variations are important, which ones aren't, and whatnot. And what it found is that there are two very specific clay groups for the ceramics. So these are two unique clay patterns, two unique types of clay that were used to form each of the individual ceramics. And then there's an outlier. And the outlier has a lot of similarities with the local material, but there's enough variation that something may have been added or something may have been removed that would indicate that it's not just using one of those local materials. And then kind of, we discussed it earlier, but I really like getting back to it because it shows the potential of the technique, that slipped piece. We didn't actually analyze the slip, the outer slip. We focused on analyzing the actual ceramic body that is underneath the slip. And that actually matched two of the unslipped, undecorated sherds. So we know that at least that was using the same source material. Now, were they made by the same group or the same individual? There's no way that we can tell that. But we do know that it came from the same source material, or likely came from the same source material.
Gotcha. And so out of a total, 13 Southwestern sherds have been recovered from Tobias, one from y'all's excavation in 2019, and then 12 more from earlier investigations. And like, Southwest pottery is very different than Great Plains pottery. Like, that is a firm cultural boundary, more so than like Plains to American Bottom or Midwest, where there's some commonalities, but the Southwest is very different. Bob, how cool is it seeing come out of the ground? I mean, first and foremost.
With the Southwestern stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a screamy moment. Yeah, you hear a little scream, a little hoot come up from the unit, and everyone goes over there. It is like, you know, there's this beautiful glazed piece of pottery, nice design on it. Yeah, it's really nice. And the implication, you know, it's from that far away.
Absolutely. And yeah. So for you, Zach, what is this? What do these results tell us about who people are interacting with or what's going on?
So for Tobias, there's a few things going on. The lack of any real Cotto materials being found there, whereas you find a lot in the lower Walnut. I think that really indicates strongly, and the fact that we do have the Southwestern sherd, as well as a lot of things from the Rio Grande, the Rio area, Western Pueblos, a lot of materials that seem to be matching up with that, really strongly indicates that the Tobias site has a really strong interaction network of some sort. We don't know if it was just trading directly for the ceramics, if it was a population movement, if it was trading for what's in the pots, or the pots themselves were considered status goods. We don't know enough yet to be able to really say beyond, we do know that they have a really strong and a really high level of interaction with more southwestern populations and not as much populations to the southeast or to the east.
But I'd like to jump in on that too. We do have some Great Bend aspect hunting sites out in western Nebraska. They're ephemeral compared to sites like Tobias, but there's distinctive pottery there. It's a clear indication that folks are out there. And so they're, you know, there's potential, clearly Great Bend aspect people are getting out into western Kansas in closer proximity to southwestern folks. And so they're closer proximity to Dismal River as well. So there's potential for meeting in the middle, so to speak, out in the high plains.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, that the river that the site is next to, right, which is the Arkansas, goes right past Pueblo, Colorado, and is fed by snowmelt in the Rocky Mountains. And that's well within the Southwest interaction sphere. And like late 14, you know, the 1400s and 1700s is a time of the Mississippians, chiefdoms that people think about are gone in a sense that like Cahokia is no longer prominent. We're back to a period where folks are reforming, ethnogenesis is reoccurring. And we see in the plains a lot that these systems in the Southeast and Southwest, as they disappear and come back, as they start coming back, the plains becomes that interaction sphere for trade between the Southeast, the Midwest, and the Northwest. And so it, to me, it makes sense of like, oh, they're going back to these old trade relationships and seeing where this site is on the Arkansas River. It's like a dead ringer of like, oh, that's a perfect spot where you just have to follow the Arkansas from Colorado and boom, you're in Wichita country, and that being a major interaction sphere.
That's a really good point. We should have put that in the paper.
If you guys want to do a second one, I'll be a third author. I'm hungry for publications. Don't tempt me.
Yeah, we'll do a PS.
Yeah. And so where does this leave us, both you, Bob and Zach, with the future directions of research at Tobias and related Great Bend aspects, or even other regions from Kansas? Of, you know, like Zach, are you interested to get back into the Hopewell collections at KU? What is next for our listeners?
I feel settled pretty much on the Tobias ceramics, and so I'm starting to work on other aspects of the sites, the lithics in particular. So I'm anxious to see what correlations there are between the patterns that we see in ceramics and then as well as the lithics. So that's the next step. That paper is in production.
Excellent. Well, if it's in Plains, Bob, we'll have you back on to talk about it.
For me, when it comes to the Tobias site, I think there's a lot of research that could be done to expand what we know about ceramic production. For example, we really only focused on just the immediately local clay materials. But for my dissertation, it goes into great detail discussing how populations, the 90 percentile of sites and populations, would travel anywhere up to 7 kilometers to gather local clay sources to create local ceramics. So we can expand that out to, you know, more raw clay sources in the area to try to see if we can't track down more specifically where the material was that was being used to produce that. Alternatively, you could find out something that you didn't expect, and I don't recommend trying to do this, but if you find it, I always love it. A good example of this is in my dissertation, we looked at 13 raw clay sources from all over Kansas. And I wasn't expecting to be able to say, well, this ceramic sherd is not local, it's exotic to this site, but we were able to actually figure out the large overarching area source that ceramic likely was made from in clays, and it was over 250 kilometers away for that material. So using these types of techniques to try to maybe map out how the ceramics or the clays are moving over the terrain, I think opens a lot of doors to trying to understand more how the interaction with people at the Tobias site, the Great Bend aspect, all of these. And it's not just for, you know, Tobias or Great Bend, but anybody who does ceramics. Hopewell is always a great example. Kansas City Hopewell are known as that because for the longest time, Kansas City was thought to be the westernmost extent. And we have clear examples of Kansas City Hopewell pottery in the middle of Kansas. So, you know, there's always more that you can research, and you can start getting into some of those nitty-gritty details about, okay, we understand now that it's not local material. How can we go to the next step and start seeing where it's actually coming from and how it's moving over the terrain?
Excellent. Well, thank you both so much for being on the podcast. I'm really excited for this new partnership with Plains and be able to promote more of the research coming out of Plains Anthropologist. And for those listening, the link to access the article, if you're already a Plains Anthropology member, is down below, or it's a link to you to be told you need to be a member, and you should do that. And then you can access the article as well as all the back issues of Plains Anthropologist. Now, with that being said, the big conference in this October is in Lincoln, Nebraska, the home of the Plains Anthropological Society annual meeting. So as a member, you get reduced registration, but we'll be talking more about that as the conference gets closer. So with that, thank you all for listening, and I will see you guys next time. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarchpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.